Blog Talk Radio.
Assalamu alaikum, and welcome to the Elevated Places Network presents A Time for Justice. Thank you for listening to our show, A Time for Justice. Thank you for tuning in as this show discusses legal and current events in a round table discussion of legal minds. We discuss this country's centuries-long failure to apply, uphold, and enforce the laws, and the overall failure of the legal system to give justice, and the negative impacts these failures have had on Black people and their Black families. Ultimately, we want fair dealing. We want justice under the law, but all too often, this is not the actions that we see. My name is Sister Pamela Muhammad, and I'm an attorney. And our guest tonight will not make those excuses for the racist conduct that is often seen, which are really just distractions from the truth, which is the path to justice and equal protection. So talk about just, fair, and equitable solutions, which are in the best interests of the people. As I said, my name is Sister Pamela Muhammad, and you are tuned in to A Time for Justice. If you would like to join the discussion, please press the number 1 to get into the host queue. Now, I am very excited tonight, family. We have two dynamic attorneys that are going to talk to us about our topic is defending the innocent, standards and proofs in an unjust system. Yes, this system, as we know, is an unjust system, and it is really the spirit of the Black lawyer who defends the innocent. And this is the actual framework that we find ourselves in since we have been brought here, kidnapped 450 years ago, 400 plus years ago. But our lawyers, we the ones especially that the Elevated Places has network, A Time for Justice, has been so blessed to bring to the round table. These are lawyers who have the spirit to make sure that justice is given to their clients, or that at least the fight for justice is something that they don't fear, they don't shy away from. We're going to really have a great conversation tonight as we have some very awesome attorneys. First off, I would like to bring up our brother. We have a brother attorney by the name of Jimmy C. Morris. Brother Jimmy C. Morris is the managing partner at Morris Law Firm, PA. He practices in the area of criminal defense, civil rights, civil litigation, and personal injury. He is admitted to the bar in Arkansas, both in state and federal court. He is also admitted to the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals. Mr. Morris is a native of Arkansas. He attended the University of Arkansas at Pine Bluff, the University of Arkansas at Little Rock, where he has earned an associate degree in law enforcement, bachelor's in political science and criminal justice, and he actually received his law degree from the Arkansas School of Law. Mr. Morris, our brother, Brother Jimmy, he is a member of the Omega Psi Phi fraternity and other organizations that are just so numerous. He is just an awesome, active brother. He's also the very proud parent of a son who carries his name and also his daughter. So without further ado, I'm going to open up Brother Jimmy's mic and welcome him to the show. Let's see.
Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum salam. Yes, sir, I can hear you just perfectly, Brother Jimmy. Welcome, welcome to... Yes, sir.
I heard that intro, and I was looking for who y'all were talking about.
Oh, yes, sir. You're being humble because this brother here, audience, is a dynamic lawyer who is just always working, very hard working, brother. So thank you so much, Brother Jimmy, to
absolutely
honor us coming on the show.
And I apologize for the last time I actually got stuck in a pretrial hearing on a case that was for a guy facing life in prison, and we ended up trying that case 2 weeks after that, and suffice to say, you know, my client was found not guilty. I won't say he walked out with me, but I will say he was found not guilty in the case he was facing life, so everything else for him is downhill.
Yes, yes. So you will definitely be able to talk to us about defending, and especially sometimes when people are innocent. But everybody deserves legal representation and quality legal representation, and that's what you do. Because our audience, we have to make sure we understand. He was saying that he was in court after hours, like 7 o'clock. It was late, and he was texting me. He's like, I'm coming. But, you know, this is what dedicated lawyers sometimes do, especially in these different circumstances that we're in. Let me bring on our next guest, and then we can open up our conversation. I would like to also bring on Sister Tiffany Muhammad, who is a licensed attorney and an entrepreneur. Sister Tiffany has a track record of strategic thinking and effective leadership. Her work experience with executing assigned tasks, limited scope, complexity. So she does a lot of business as well as immigration as well as other types of law. And so, you know, this is where, again, lawyers do, they do problem solving, they do decision making, training people to do these type of things, strategic solutions. That's Sister Tiffany. She is currently working at a law office in Los Angeles where she provides advice and consultations to U.S. citizens and immigrants seeking information on political asylums, green cards, work permits, know your rights, and she helps these immigrants, our immigrant family, prepare family petitions and other things in the immigrant immigration law standard, you know, in that particular setting. I just wanted to say that Sister Tiffany is also a double graduate of the Thurgood Marshall system, Texas Southern undergraduate degree, as well as a graduate of the Thurgood Marshall School of Law, which is a Texas Southern University, which is at Texas Southern University. So without further ado, I want to go ahead and open up Sister Tiffany's mic. And Sister Tiffany.
Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam, Sister Tiffany. Thank you. Yes, ma'am.
Thank
how are you?
Oh, alhamdulillah. Thank you so much, Sister Pamela Muhammad, Attorney Pamela Muhammad. And also, I always have to make sure I mention and being thankful for Dr. Ava, Attorney Ava Muhammad, for this opportunity,
yes,
this
yes.
platform. And thank you so much, Sister Pam. Your show is so incredibly valuable. I know that the listeners, you know, believers, not believers, it's just such important information that it's not accessible, you know, just random regularly. So I just definitely hope the listeners out there continue to listen and let you know that we totally value the information, the dedication, and the weekly shows. And I'm very grateful to have the opportunity to be able to say some words. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. All praises are due to Allah. I really appreciate those words. All praises due to Allah. And as you say, the Elevated Places Network with our very own sister, Dr. Ava Muhammad, that comes on Thursdays at 7 Central Standard Time as well. So we have to remember to tune in to her show as well. And I want to take this time because we're family, everybody listening, Brother Jimmy, myself, Sister Tiffany. We've all worked together for years, you know, at least as colleagues and networking. And so we're family. And we do have to take the time to, you know, say a prayer and remember those of our family who are in the New Orleans area that, you know, the whole state of Louisiana, which has just been hit by, you know, really I would say catastrophic, it appears, with really unknown damages, the proportion of the damages suffered as that hurricane came in and swept up, you know, the Gulf Coast and the Mississippi and going on. And I think that we all, even though we may not be in Louisiana, we all have been touched by that situation. I have family here, you know, that had to travel out. Texas is a place where you're going to have lots of people coming in from Louisiana, and you're going to have lots of people whose families are in Louisiana. So we've got to make sure we pray for those families as well as families in Mississippi and wherever else this damage has occurred.
Yep.
Just wanted to really say that because when we talk about the innocent and we talk about our topic for tonight, what I wanted to look at was, okay, we know that this system has been unjust since, you know, we've been brought here, and we can look at cases going back to the Scottsboro boys. I thought that was a very interesting scenario in research because many of us know that in 1931 there were black men, black boys, riding on a train in Scottsboro, Alabama, and I think their ages were ranging from 12 to 19, and two white girls came forward alleging, of course, that they had raped them, and all of these young men claimed innocence and were innocent, but after a trial, eight of the nine were convicted and actually sentenced to death. You know, that case now comes up because I think the Alabama legislature has, you know, recently exonerated or actually looked at, you know, this type of injustice. But this is what we see. This is our world. So we want to talk about attorneys who deal with this type of scheming and tactics and evidence and know how to kind of walk around the courts and have that spirit. And that's one of the things I know Brother Jimmy, who's been practicing now for years and years, can tell us about. Also, you know, we don't want to just think that this is in the 30s. We recently, it's an article where a black man in Missouri, actually after spending four decades in jail for a crime that he did not commit and many others believe he didn't commit, he's finally being brought in by a judge who's, I think, or even the prosecutor is saying, let's look at this. Let's look at letting him out. Let's look at exonerating him. But look at this. His whole life has been spent, wasted, taken by this egregious conduct that many times we see in the trial systems of the courts of America. And, you know, we talk about police brutality, you know, we talk about, which is really very horrible, but we want to talk about the type of brutality that goes on in courtrooms and the ways that lawyers have to deal with this, the
the actual character of the black lawyer with the right attitude and spirit to fight in a courtroom. So let's just get right into it. Brother Jimmy, I know you have worked in this framework, and is it difficult as a black man, you know, seeing this injustice as well as doing a very difficult job? I'm just going to kind of throw it out there. We're informal with this. Can you, you know, please share with us?
I will tell you it's a very difficult job because you have to navigate really well to even get a little bit of justice. You know, I always tell people that often places I go, I'm too black, and then I go to other places, I'm not black enough. And generally when you're in court, you're either the only black man or there are very few, especially in the rural South, and I live in Arkansas. So I've had bailiffs stop me and say, this is only for lawyers. I've had individuals tell me that defendants, you know, I'm a well-dressed defendant, but I shouldn't speak. I should let my lawyer speak for me. So I've gotten it from both sides of the coin. My mentor, John Walker, was a civil rights lawyer who graduated law school in, I believe, 64 or 65. So he told me about him having arguments in court about being called a Negro versus a nigger, coming in the back door, not being allowed in the front door. So to be where we are, you know, we've come a long way, but still have a long way to go. The tricks that are used nowadays to prevent justice generally have been to prey on our mercy, our forgiveness, and the way that they keep a lot of black people off the juries in Arkansas. Well, first of all, you have to be a registered voter. You have to be a registered voter. Now, we fought in the major black areas to have them do it by driver's license. But you have to convince black people to want to be on juries because first thing they want to do is get off. And so, you know, we've had a lot of public meetings where we're telling them why they should be able to vote and why they should be involved in politics and why they should be involved in juries. But suffice to say, even if they get into the jury veneer, they ask, are you able to judge another person? Praying on the Bible Belt and them being atypical good Christian people who don't want to sit in judgment of others. And so when a black person says, I can't judge a person, or what they'll do in a small drug case, they'll say, well, the range of punishment is 10 to life. Could you see giving a life sentence for drugs? And most black folks, good-hearted black folks, will say, no, I can't see that. And then they try to get them off for not being able to consider the full range of punishment. So for us, it's educating black people, keeping them on the jury, giving them opportunity to make a decision, and then translating the black culture to white people to get them to understand that just because someone is standing on the corner doesn't mean they're doing something illegal. Just because they're afraid of the police doesn't mean they did something. You know, you have to give them a lot of background. One of the stories I've told in court is that if a black man doesn't have a job, which in our community, if the unemployment rate is 10%, you know, our unemployment rate is somewhere around 20%, 27%, whatever. And what happens is if a brother has a conviction for anything, I mean, even in Arkansas, misdemeanors are keeping people from getting
Brother
jobs.
Jimmy, you're a little garbled. Your call.
Is this better? Okay, let me try to go to a better.
Okay,
let's see if I can do it differently. Okay. Is this better? Is this any better?
Keep going. Yes, sir, that's better.
Okay, so I'll tell you what, let me go to, as they say, higher ground.
Okay, and while he's doing that, what he's discussing is this: you are entitled to a jury of your peers. So, if a black defendant
is being tried in all by all white juries, which we know that's a problem, then they're not getting any kind of semblance of any kind of, you know, relatable person. And so I don't know, Brother Jimmy, are you here?
Yeah, I am. And I think the case I had left, last week was a young black boy, and we filed a motion, and it was a Hail Mary motion. And the motion that we filed was we wanted the jury veneer to represent a percentage or cross-section of the community. Problem was, in the particular county I was in, the percentage of the community that was white was 87%, and it was over 50. Suffice to say, we figured out a way to help that young brother out, but it was not by going to trial. But what I often try to do is like translate our experiences. So I try to explain to him them that if this brother who is unemployed is standing on the corner or getting out of the house and going to the barbershop or something like that, it's because maybe his wife, his girlfriend, whoever has a job, his mother has a job, and he can't sit around the house. So he got to be out of the house while they're at work because nobody wants to see this brother sitting on the couch doing nothing. So he goes somewhere, i.e. the barbershop, the corner, just to hang out so he won't get barked at when he gets home. Now, a lot of people on the jury, when you see, you know, white men start to, oh, I get it. Yeah, I've been there. Like, I've had an off day, and she had the honey-do list, and I would have rather been somewhere else. You start to get them to appreciate the experience and not look at it in a negative standpoint. Because what a lot of white people don't understand is this. A black man, well, let me say this. A white man with a felony conviction has a better chance of getting a job than a black man with a degree in Arkansas. They know, you know, they know other people that may take a chance on them. And so the reality of these things, you have to begin to translate those things for them. I'll give you another example. I had a case, and I tried. We have what you call a per curiam. A per curiam is a unanimous decision by the Supreme Court of Arkansas to not have any jury trials up until May 3rd of this year. So on May 3rd of this year, we were back running. And so I've had four or five trials this summer. And so I had a case where my client was accused of shooting someone in broad daylight, and he was on video shooting the person in broad daylight and confessed. Well, the backstory was that the guy he tried to kill had earlier that day tried to crawl in bed with his daughter naked and assault her, and she was 17. And the further backstory was that she called the police, and the police officer came out and actually did nothing. He said, oh, I don't believe you, and went on about his business. So in those instances, I had two factions fighting. I had five white men, older black women on the jury, which was a beautiful thing. I mean, if nothing else, I was going to hang it because one of them grandmothers could not stop agreeing with every point I said. But what I did was I went and when I'm making my argument to them in my closing, I made an argument to the white men first. And the argument to the white men first was, had this been my daughter, this would have been a capital murder case because the person would have been dead. I wouldn't stop shooting until I made sure they were down. She would have checked their pulse, you know. And the white man who loved
assaulting your daughter, right?
Yeah, right. But wow. But see, I couldn't dig into, you know, my perspective because they can't relate to that. But what they can relate to is guns, want to defend their family, and by God, if someone touches my daughter, you know, that I don't approve of, I have a right to bring a gun out. That's rural Arkansas now. So I got them on board because once I said, if it was my daughter, you know, we don't know where we would be. And I said, the problem is you don't know what you would do either. And when you saw older white men that we had nothing in common other than the fact that we would probably kill a man because he raped our daughter, I had them. And so once I had them, then I turned to the sisters. And when I turned to the sisters, what I said to them was, think about this. think about being a young black sister, and you do everything by the book, and someone tries to do something to you, and you do what everybody in society tells you to do. You don't take matters into your own hands. You call the police. And you call the police, and the police treat you like everybody else. They don't believe you. Now, every black woman in there damn near started crying because it has been something in their life that has affected them where somebody didn't believe them. And generally it was because a cousin, brother, or somebody did something to them, or they knew somebody, or their daughter. So everybody was affected by young black women telling them, somebody has touched me, somebody has grabbed me, somebody has done something, and nobody believed them. So once I had them on the hookup, you understand what it's like to not be believed in this society. And when you see grandma shaking her head, now I got 5 and 5. So the other two, either it was going to be a hung jury or they're going to side with one of the two. They were a black man and I think a Mexican man. But my point is, I spent a lot of time trying to find the point that get the jury on my side, even if they don't know me, like me, or will agree with my politics, if they really knew me. I get superficially, okay. I find out what their politics are, and then get them to be able to agree with the premise I put forth. And I tell you, I leave court sometimes, and I can't even order anything to eat or a cup of coffee because it's mentally exhausting.
Wow. Wow. Yeah, that's beautiful, and it kind of reminds me of one of our sayings on the show. We like to quote Charles Hamilton Houston, who said, a lawyer is either a social engineer or a parasite on society. And I think what I'm hearing from you is the creativity that you have to use when you're fighting for our people, because our circumstances are different, our fact patterns are different, and you have to really use your brain. So that's really a great story, Brother Jimmy. And you know, Sister Tiffany, I don't know if you wanted to add anything on that, but I want to go into the innocence issue and what is going on where we're seeing innocent people, or you may know your client is innocent, but the trial is done in such a way, uncharged misconduct. In today's society, we're seeing a lot of allegations, you know, with no proof, allegations with no evidence, you know, witness who don't have any kind of corroboration, they're not reliable, and then people get into these trials and all this evidence is thrown at them. I think it's called uncharged misconduct, and sometimes people get confused. They think these are real crimes. But really, they're not. Mm-hmm. They're just allegations. So, Brother Jimmy, can you give us some of that backdrop? Because I think we hear this so much now. Just because somebody accuses you of something, that doesn't mean that it's actually a crime, that you've actually been charged with a crime. And this is very prejudicial a lot of times. That's the point. It makes an innocent person sometimes appear guilty.
Right.
So
generally they're supposed to follow certain rules. And this particular rule, at least I think you're talking about 404. And it gives them a little bit of leeway when you start to get to the B exception. And the B exception is motive, modus operandi, you know, things that show that this person may have done it before, may have done something before that lines up with this, that is anything other than character. Theoretically,
right,
character evidence is supposed to be excluded to show conformity therewith. But if they get these exceptions,
right,
and what prosecutors have become...
Okay, let me stop you real quick, because you're doing an excellent job walking us through this. So when he's talking about character evidence, if I'm charged with a crime, you can't use evidence to say, well, you know, she's just a no good person. You know, well, I don't like the way she looks, or, you know, this is evidence. Character is that mental and moral quality. So a lot of times you're having something that might not be actual evidence. It may not be proof. It's just somebody trying to impugn and throw mud and attack someone's credibility. And we've got rules in court that say you just can't do that. The evidence has to be probative. It has to have some other reason other than just to attack my character because you don't like me. So this is kind of where he's going with that. So yes, sir. I'm sorry. We gotta make sure our lay people.
Thank you. Beautiful. I taught college for so long. Sometimes I get professorial. So way to slow me down. And I pulled it up while you were doing that. And so 404B, you can use to show. That there was an opportunity, intent, knowledge, or absence of mistake. And each state has several other exceptions that they allow in. But what prosecutors have become accustomed to doing is trying to find anything that lines up with the crime at hand that a person has done previously. And it does not have to match, It doesn't have to match perfectly, but it also doesn't have to be proven. So if Pookie says that two nights ago you walked into the grocery store with a gun and put it to someone's back, it doesn't matter if there's no other evidence than Pookie saying it.
Right.
If it lines up with the crime they're alleging, they can say, well, see, look, this shows his motive. This shows his modus operandi. He always takes in a revolver with two bullets in there. And what it also does, it also shows or makes the jury believe that if you did a criminal act on this time, then you probably criminal act at the case at bar.
It's not real quick, just so everybody's clear, because these are not criminal. They're uncharged conduct. So we can't even say if they're criminal, did they happen? So I just wanted to throw that out there.
Well, and the funny part about it is there are cases in which uncharged or validated facts can be brought in as 404B evidence, even though the person may have been convicted of a same or similar crime, but that might be excluded because the person hasn't taken a stand. And so that's the oddity of this. And let me try to explain it very carefully. If a person doesn't take the stand, oftentimes their priors cannot be brought into evidence unless somewhere other the door is opened up, because it's considered prejudicial to say that a person committed a crime before, so therefore they probably would do this. In Arkansas, we even sever what they call felons in possession from other crimes, because if they're charging a felon in possession, that gives a jury an indication that this person is a felon, and so they probably did some other crimes. And so the back door on a lot of this stuff is the 404B, the uncharged stuff, the stuff that it doesn't really matter if it's true or not. It just sticks to the wall and makes a person look more guilty than not. And unless you are good at keeping them out and have a favorable judge, and I don't even want to say a just judge. I don't really like just judges. I like favorable judges. You want a favorable judge that will at least say, you know what, that shouldn't come in, to at least give the defendant a fair shot. And what I always tell, and prosecutors always say, we need this case to be fair to the state or the United States government. That's a lie. We need it to be fair to the defendant. It can be prejudicial as all get out to the state or U.S. government. Because the only person that has certain rights related to a crime is a defendant. And so what I always tell judges, that's what I believe. I believe the Constitution backed that one up. You know, the right to a speedy trial, the right to these things is given to
the right to a fair trial.
A criminal defendant in the United States. Those same rights do not to non-U.S. citizens in the United States. And so theoretically, they're not talking about a government entity being protected by giving them certain rights. They're talking about a citizen. And so what I always remind them is a citizen needs protection. And if a citizen needs protection, then he should get the benefit of the doubt in the trial. So if these uncharged crimes are brought into evidence, it would lean more towards giving the state an advantage and not protecting the citizen. That's something else that I do.
Okay.
I spent a lot of time talking about innate principles to the jury, because even if they don't like Jimmy, and a lot of them don't, and a lot of them may not like, you know, I don't try to pull wool over the
eye.
They may not
like
me they may not like me because they don't like what I look like, what my skin tone is.
Okay.
But what I make it hard to do is argue with President Adams or President Jefferson or George Washington. You know, I take
principles,
things that I see on Fox and that Trump talks about, and I spin them, and I say, look, a citizen should get protection in these United States. I may even ask them, if someone was coming to take your gun and you didn't have a felony, what would you do? I'd make them take it out of my cold, dead hand. That's one right. What about the right not to speak? I agree with that right, too. Well, good. You know, now we're on the same page. And so remind them that I say our forefathers, but their forefathers, because my forefathers were still, you know, picking cotton and doing everything else. But the forefathers of this country set up certain rights because they didn't trust government or prosecutors or kangaroo courts. And remind them of that. And it became a lot easier when Trump kept reminding them that the government was not very good. But it's still held through Biden.
Interesting. So I think breaking down, and Sister Tiffany, I want to bring you in too to talk about some of the stereotypes and myths, and because really this is what this is a lot of slander that is being thrown into trials, and we have rules to try to keep it out, but oftentimes, especially today, we're seeing people try by conjecture, slander, stereotypes, and really inadmissible evidence. But I just want to say, Brother Jimmy brought up a lot of great points. He talked about the defendant's right to remain silent. He talked about why we see sometimes defendants who are in trial not take stand. So if you ever wonder, well, why doesn't that person say something? Some of what he was explaining to us has a lot to do why sometimes it's best for a defendant not to take a stand and maintain his right to remain silent. And so, Sister Tiffany, you were going to add? Yes, ma'am?
Oh, yes, ma'am. Very enjoying very much the program. Brother Jimmy has really given us a lot of insight.
Yeah, he's a trial lawyer for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Trial lawyer myself, I was going to add, when you were initially the program title, Defending the Innocent. So for me, stepping a little side from the trial and litigation segment, I just want the listeners to really, really kind of look at defending the innocent and ask ourselves the hard question. Do we perceive our people as innocent? One might ask, or even look at the bigger picture with who's the I call him not the public defender, but the defender of all defenders, right? The Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan, and he defends, defends us. So what I'm saying in regards to our topic and with racial justice, I just want to know, we have to really ask ourselves with criminalization. You started off talking, you were saying about the myths of it all. You know, as we know that the criminalization of black people, especially specifically, historically, the black man being a criminal. I mean, just look at that. From, you know, we come from one position as, you know, so-called slaves of these white people. And then a few years later, now we are supposed as to be criminals. So I just want everyone to really ask themselves when we look at our youth today. Do we, when the pants are sagging, and do we assume, you know, that our people, are they innocent or are they not? So I just want us to think a little deeper into that, because you got to know it's based on propaganda and sheer myth. Our people, we do things, of course, but we know it's a result, you know, of a situation. So I was just looking at the rising crime rates. Were they a result of mass incarceration? We all should be familiar with the talks of mass incarceration being compared to the modern Jim Crow, right? When we think of the drug war, is it rooted in getting rid of violent kingpins? Most illegal drug, these are myths. Most illegal drug activity, does it happen in a ghetto? Not. It's not facts. Right. Black youth more likely to engage in illegal drug activity than whites. Wrong. You must have never lived amongst them because the white boys got it. They do commit, statistically, they commit more drug crimes. How about broken homes, bad schools? Are these the reasons why so many black and brown are incarcerated? No. There are the facts in the data states, you know, today, look at it. More blacks are under the criminal justice correction system, prison, jail, probation, than there were enslaved in 1850. That's a decade before the Civil War. 2016, we had more black men disenfranchised than in 1870, the year the 15th Amendment was ratified, that prohibits the laws that explicitly denied the right for to vote based on race. So I'm just saying, if you look at these facts and you can see the systematic and what has happened and why we're where we are, you can get yourself, you can kind of get into reality and understand the myth and the propaganda that our people have been made to look like these criminals. And, of course, the Jim Crow literacy test, poll taxes, they were all used to keep blacks from the polls. Today, felon disenfranchisement, it does the job even better. And then also I read something that said a black child born today has a less chance to be raised by both parents than a child born during slavery. So we can find, you know, look at mass incarceration for all of this. So when you're talking about defending the innocent, of course, Brother Jimmy's doing a beautiful job and giving us the actual trial and litigation and the rules of evidence that governs this. The justice. And he's doing a wonderful job in Arkansas. But you have to, you'd be remiss if you don't look at what where it all comes from. I mean, even the fact that convict leasing was a system born right after the Civil War, which after the collapse of slavery, black men were arrested in mass. They were targeted for extremely minor crimes, you know, hanging around, you know, not having a job. So all these things, like, and of course we know, and then I was very surprised looking at the stats of the explosion of the penitentiary or the incarceration from 1970 went from 300,000, and today it's well over 2 million. You know, we're this country, United States, has the most incarcerated persons, of course, black and brown being way too disproportionate. So it tells the whole story there. There's no other country that incarcerates disproportions of racial minorities like the United States. So I was just looking, again, defending the innocent. So, you know, that's why is it three-fourth males in D.C. are expected to experience prison, you know? And then when you look at the sociologists and the criminologists, they prove that it says crime rates have little to do with incarceration rates. So how is it independent, you know, when we're the so-called war on drugs? So that's not specifically what we're discussing tonight, but I just wanted to bring that basis, that backdrop, to when we're talking about defending our people. And of course, you state what type, you know, are black lawyers best suited to defend our people? I would have to say emphatically yes, because what Brother Jimmy brings to the table, not just his skill set and expertise, but he also has the spirit and also has the desire to get the justice the client. Yeah, so I can go on and on. But anyway, I just wanted to add that when we're talking about these myths, because they are that is exactly what they are, and we have to definitely be aware of what's going on.
Yeah, I think that was awesome because, like you say, this is exactly what we're talking about because it's a roundtable discussion, and we have to look at this thing from different perspectives. But as we're saying, it's the same issue in unjust system, racial injustice. Brother Jimmy's explaining to us how he has to humanize the black man because the black man stands on the corner and people look at black men standing on a corner because why? That's a problem. That's the dehumanization that Sister Tiffany's talking about. And Brother Jimmy is actually putting on those boots and going into this courtroom and using creativity to help this brother get some relief. So I just think it's beautiful. And I just wanted to say, because we're going to take a caller, but you know, we're talking about standards and proofs, and a standard under the law is something established by authority, custom, or general consent as a model. And that's something that's supposed to measure the quantity and the quality. And I think what Sister Tiffany is saying, we can use this standard to our reaction in the Black community is our standard of how we're responding. What do we expect? What do we accept? And how do we view our people? Are we raising our standards to say, you will not treat our people or myself like this, because I am, you know, a God. I am, you know, a child of the Most High. So I think it's a beautiful discussion. Let's go ahead and open up the call. We have Sister Donna, who has a comment. Let's see.
Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam, Sister Donna. How are you, ma'am?
Mm-hmm. I am well, thank Allah. So to Sister host, Attorney Pamela, and to your esteemed panelists this evening, Attorney Jimmy and Attorney Tiffany, first of all, thank you, because I have been really enlightened this evening, and I just want to speak real quickly on that. As Attorney Jimmy just went over in a trial about not bringing up all the past stuff. And
yes,
and that's a really justified reason. I didn't know that. I couldn't do it. And so, honestly, the first thing that came to my mind, though, Attorney Jimmy, as you were laying out how you spoke to the white men first, I thought about To Kill a Mockingbird. That's what popped into my head, and how he did. But it seems like now what's happening is the media is taking the place of that. As soon as something happens, they go and run down all of the background of the person in an uncharged crime. And so a lot of times it seems like there's people already coming in with a bias. If it's one of those cases that made the news, that they're doing what's not even allowed in the court system. So I was glad to know about that doesn't, you know, that's not even supposed to stand. But I can see how things can be biased against us, even just walking in the door, if it's something that makes it to the media, which ties into what I think Attorney Tiffany, when she was saying, then how do we see our people? Because we'll buy right into that narrative as if the deserved it because of, you know, this. You did this over here. You stole something from somebody, so you deserve to be shot for this incident over here. So I just see that the media is doing what isn't even allowed in court. And so, again, I just want to thank you for enlightening us. It's really my first time hearing extensively from a trial lawyer. So thank you again for this quality programming, Sister Attorney Pamela. I am really educated and empowered every week by this program, as we all should be in. Yes, ma'am. We got to spread it far and wide.
Listening. All praises are due to Allah, Sister Donna. Thank you so much for calling, Sister. Yeah, I agree with you. I thought that was unique and very groundbreaking what Brother Jimmy was telling us, because what he's saying, well, I won't say what he's saying, but one of the things he's talking about is what you call evidence, and how there's some evidence. You know, a trial is, and law is really a system of rules. And so just like a basketball game or a volleyball game, you know, you got to have an umpire, that's the judge, and lawyers on each side. And so some things are not, you know, you got to be able to call the score. You got to be able to call the foul. And so, Brother Jimmy, talk to us about objections being made, because a lot of times if a lawyer doesn't make an objection and allows evidence in that's not, shouldn't be in, that's not admissible, then that's very harmful, as well as sometimes, of course, we raise objections and the judge just may deny it. But can you set those parameters and enlighten our listeners some more on how that works to exclude, you know, things that shouldn't be in? Thank you.
Absolutely. One of the things I want to say, the sister mentioned To Kill a Mockingbird, and one of the things I do before I go on the trial, I always read this quote by Atticus Fitch, and it's, courage is not a man with a gun in his hand. It's knowing you're licked before you begin, but you begin anyway, and you see it through no matter what. You rarely win, but sometimes you do. Sometimes when I go into cases, and I work as a private attorney, but I also get assigned cases by the Public Defender Commission. And some of the cases, they give me the file, they give me the appointment, and they say, look, just make a record, and we'll appeal it for you. And it's funny because every time they said that, I've ended up getting a not guilty. So they stopped saying
that. Go ahead.
But one of the ways we do it is by trying to get evidence, the evidence that's going to come into court limited. I will give you an example, and this is not a case that I am necessarily proud of, but it's a case that illustrates the point. I had a client, and the client was a two-time loser sex offender. He had been convicted of sex offenses twice, which means in the state of Arkansas, if he gets a third one, it's life in prison. So he was facing life in prison. In Arkansas, you have to give the defense notice if they file a request notice. You have to give them notice of 404B, any evidence you're going to bring in to show motive, modus operandi, any of that stuff we talked about before. And so they decided they were going to bring in his prior crime, and it was something very similar but not necessarily on point. In this crime, he didn't sexually assault someone. He just touched someone inappropriate that was underage. But they got it to where they could get it in. And so the day of trial, we find out that that witness didn't appear and that witness didn't want to be part of the trial. I think that they put her on the stand in the pretrial just to get our client to go ahead and plead. And once our client didn't plead, they couldn't get her back, which happens a lot. And so now, without bringing in that 404B evidence, they had no way of sneaking in the fact that he was a sex offender. Well, in the first part of the case, when the witnesses identified themselves, one of the witnesses was going to be for sentencing, but she was over the sex offender registry. So I immediately objected and got that whole jury panel thrown out. So we started on a Tuesday. That whole jury panel was thrown out. We came back Wednesday with another jury panel, and that witness was no longer on their witness list. So now there's nobody that can get in any evidence that he was a sex offender. Keeping that evidence out meant now you had to go by the credibility of the witnesses. And the credibility of the witnesses was horrible because these young girls were people who had escaped from a youth home, so they were already considered quote-unquote bad apples. And then when they ran away from the youth home, they talked about the crimes they committed along the way, which gave me a tactical advantage because my client's priors weren't in, but these witnesses now are in. Yeah. And so all along the way, I kept out stuff that would hurt my client and allowed in stuff that would help my client. And what I'm telling you about the objections is because every objection we made was geared to keep something out. So I, in my closing, talked about where the young girls had lied, stole, ran away, did everything that was against the law and policies. And then the prosecutor stood up and said, well, when they told the truth about these crimes he did, everything that could have been done to them had been done to them. Well, I objected immediately. Yeah. And I went up to the bench, and this was supposed to be heard outside the hearing of the jury, and I'm hurry up. But I was talking very calmly, but I was looking very animated so the jury could see how animated I was about that coming in and how the judge was agreeing with me because this is all now a show for the jury. And the prosecutor, what she did after I objected, she came back to the podium. Instead of trying to redirect what she was saying and keep it in, she skipped on to something else thinking she had the jury, and she lost the jury at that point. So a lot of times objections keep out stuff that would be harmful to your case or keep out things that would show your client's hand or opportunity or things of that nature. And so objections are, it's like a chess match. It's like you're trying to make sure the state has the weakest case they have while you're putting on your strongest case. And so objections are critical, not only for keeping evidence that would be prejudicial and detrimental to your client, but sometimes just keeping the other side from getting a flow that would be helpful to their case. And so, yes, so keeping evidence out is critical to winning a case. Because if all that evidence came in, there's no doubt that you're doing life right now.
That's right. And, you know, as you talk about the type of representation that criminal lawyers often do, you know, and a lot of times those facts are definitely distasteful to us. But, you know, we look at that same type of attitude and drive when it's, you know, given to cases where, for example, police misconduct. Now, this is another way that people are innocent. People are actually accused and going to trial. So in one case, they talk about how in Tulsa, Oklahoma, five police officers have been charged with at least 58 counts of perjury and witness tampering, which had resulted in 11 prisoners actually being released. Now, this is, again, after review, after these people have been convicted because of this 58 counts of perjury by these four officers. You know, so these are the types of cases that we're looking at where these officers are often on the stand and, you know, they are lying or the evidence is not correct. But do lawyers often object, or do lawyers, especially when it talks about black people, poor people, and some of the prosecutorial misconduct, do our people really stand up as criminal defense attorneys and object? Because what I really want our audience to walk away with is, if there aren't proper objections made to inadmissible and prejudicial evidence, then you got a slam dunk there, right, Brother Jimmy? And I guess because I've done a lot of appellate work, sometimes I look at those records, because in any trial, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, you're going to have a court reporter who has to take down everything that's being said. And so no matter what the outcome of the trial, and sometimes if there's been a conviction, you're going to have an appeal. And so oftentimes I'm looking at these records, and you're kind of like, here in Texas, was the lawyer asleep, you know, the whole trial? Did he not object? And that's a true story. There was actually a lawyer representing some black people, I believe, and, you know, may not have been black, but a lawyer who was actually asleep, you know, during the trial. Lawyers come into court drunk. And so these objections, you know, that Brother Jimmy just explained to us that have to be made, they're not being made a lot of times in our communities. So we do want to make sure that if anybody has a call, a question, or a comment, please press 1 to get into the host queue. You know, Sister Tiffany, if you want to jump in, please do. You know, and you know, but I know when we talk about articles such as Illinois will be the first state to prohibit cops from lying to kids during interrogations, you know, Brother Jimmy, you're in the state of Arkansas, so I know there are young black men, like you just described, as well, who are being subjected to trials where the evidence is just all, you know, a lot of the evidence is biased. A lot of the evidence is not reliable, not even relevant. You're having to come in and make those objections. Or maybe they, you know, they may not try it with you because they know this brother's going to stand up and he's not going to allow this innocent person to just be muddied so deep. So, yeah, that's what we're talking about. Go ahead.
One thing that I would say is this, and I'll give you another case. I had a case where my guy was charged with a lot of drugs. And what they did is, instead of charging him with a conspiracy, they charged him with two deliveries. And I believe it was 267 days, or maybe it was 967. It was a long way apart. And Arkansas has this rule of severance that says, even if a drug deal was done in the same day, two different times, it has to be severed. And so I Hail Mary'd it and said, you know, we need to sever these cases and divide them up. The judge denied it because he just denied everything. And my client ended up getting 5 life sentences plus 80 years.
Wow.
And we took that point up on appeal. That, I mean, we had several other points, but that one alone was the point that got his 5 life sentences back. He ended up getting
the
out.
The failure to sever. Is that what you said? Did you say severance,
sever.
Brother Jimmy? Now, tell people about that, because we see that even with these child removal cases where, you know, the father may have unfortunately done something bad, you know, and maybe the mother didn't, or maybe it's the mother that did something bad. But they'll try those two people together and terminate both of the parents based upon one wrongdoing when maybe this, you know, and so severance of a case. Explain, you know, how that, like you said, that impacts sometimes an outcome as well.
Well, just going to want to tie it together. I had to make a motion for it to be severed. Or
okay.
At the same time, and make a simultaneous objection to them being tried together. But severance means that evidence from this particular trial should not be entered into the next trial because the evidence combined together is going to make the jury believe that a person is guilty of both things. I'll give you an example. A person could sell drugs, and a person could be a felon in possession. But because the person is a felon, and that has to be part of the state's proof to prove he was in possession of a firearm as a felon, it now enters into the drug case that he's a felon while selling drugs. And so that further diminishes his character. The issue with the severance becomes if we let it in, then now you have this occasion that he sold drugs and that occasion that he sold drugs. So when you combine those two together, you're not looking at did he individually do it on October 8th and October 9th. You're looking at did he do it both times. So severing it makes a jury take a look at the evidence and determine did the state put in all the facts for this one charge alone.
So that particular
versus
charge,
looking
right.
At it, yes, instead of looking at it cumulative. Because what the state would do if they can is they would take every crime they could charge a person with, put it in the same case and say, he got to be guilty of something. He did all of this.
Of something,
and so
exactly.
Severance breaks that up. And some of them are, you have the absolute right to a severance, and some of them are discretionary. In that drug case,
it
was
absolute
right. And the judge.
We lost you again, Brother Jimmy. Brother Jimmy. Yeah, because as he was saying, and we're going to take a caller, but you know what? Again, it could be the person, two people, one person that's innocent, the other one that's not, and they throw them in the trial together saying that it's the same system or some reason why they come up with why these two cases need to be tried together. And then the person, of course, that's maybe more guilty or is guilty, they prejudice the person who's not guilty. So we're going to take a caller and let's see. We have a caller. Yes, caller. Yes. Well, Lake of Salaam.
Sister Marguerite.
Oh,
I have
Marguerite.
A question.
Yes, ma'am. Go
I have
right
a question
ahead.
For
no.
And I have noticed through my interaction with the judicial system that there are a lot of plea bargains. I mean, and reading about them and a lot of our people are incarcerated behind plea bargain. They never even have a trial, you know. And one case that I had been close to, even the public defender and the person, you know, kept saying they weren't guilty, and they weren't, you know, told this child to take a plea bargain and, you know, and go on with your life. And that is what irritates me, you know, this. It seems to be not about innocent until proven guilty. It's what's expeditious for maybe the public defender, the lawyers, and the judges.
Yes, ma'am. That's an excellent point. I don't know, Brother Jimmy, is he still with us?
I am. I'm still here.
Okay. Yes, sir. And so thank you, Sister Marguerite. Did you have anything else to say on that point?
Yeah, I just want to know what's up with that. You know, why is this not being, you know, from the mountaintop shouted how wrong this is, how criminal that is?
Let me say this. I think any tool that is used can be used misappropriately. But I'll give you an example of how plea bargaining helped last week. I had a client that was charged with capital murder. We were about to do a one-week capital murder case, and the evidence was daunting against him. I mean, everything from he said it to his girlfriend. He told his homeboy that he killed somebody. He wrote a letter, had it notarized. I mean, anything that Dave Chappelle could have came up with as evidence was against my client. And so I go to the prosecutor, and he was also charged with capital murder. And capital murder means that you either get a needle in your arm in Arkansas or you spend the rest of your life in prison. So my client was facing quite a bit. And what we ended up doing is we ended up getting it reduced to first-degree murder and ended up getting him a plea for 27 years. And in doing that, this young brother has the opportunity to come home in 13 years. So I can't always say that plea bargaining is bad. I also want you to understand that going to trial sometimes, you end up getting the trial tax. And the trial tax means that the prosecutor is not as interested in the case until you make them work over the weekend, over the course of a week. And if they win, then they attempt to stack it on your client so that other lawyers and other defendants are intimidated by what could happen to them. And so a lot of times lawyers who are not prepared for trials end up going to trials in cases that are not best suited for the defense they put up. And then the prosecutor, who is sometimes better at the game, ends up getting them a longer sentence. You also have to deal with, in my state, I go to different counties, and you have to deal with home cooking. So I think that when you deal with plea bargaining, you have to look at how bad or good your case is. What is the person's exposure? What are they looking at? What's the worst that can happen? What's the best that can happen? And then what is the state offering? I'll give you another example. One of my clients was offered 24 years two weeks ago. But because of witness issues, he was just offered time served. Well, I can't tell him to go risk going to prison for 20 years when they're offering you time served. I have to at least let him know that, look, these are the facts that are against you. These are the facts that are in your favor. It may work out to your favor. It may not, but right now you'd be able to walk out of jail. And I let my clients know those things and let them make the decision before we end up going to trial. And like I told you, the guy who was facing life in prison, you know, we got the prosecutor down to 20 years. He wanted to roll the dice. He rolled the dice. He was found not guilty. I've had that happen, but I've also had where I've had a person with a 2 or 3 year probation fought and ended up going to prison. So plea bargaining is a two-edged sword.
Yeah. And I would say, as we prepared for this particular show and we're talking about trials more so and trial skills, but you know, Sister Marguerite, I definitely agree that plea bargaining is overused, and it is a way that cases are put down some type of factory, some type of just pushed along the system. This is a plea bargain system, because if everybody set cases for trial, it would absolutely, you know, almost just bring the system to a stop, because I don't have the percentage of the number of cases that are plea bargained out, but they're very, very high. And oftentimes we're talking about, do you have black lawyers that are willing to represent you, you know, in the case of some of our young black youth or our young poor because justice is for sale a lot of times in the terms of, do you have the resources to hire an attorney that's going to really stick with you and fight your case, or are you going to only be able to get so much because you're either going to get a public defender who doesn't want to work, because some public defenders work. But, you know, there are just so many factors. But I think in cases where you're innocent, then you really should, and first offenders, you know, you should really consider trying your case, because so many times the pleas that people are taking lead to these long probationary periods that are a slippery slope into the criminal justice system forever, whereas potentially setting those cases for trial and just, you know, taking your chance from the beginning that you can get some justice because you're innocent is the best way. And it's interesting, I think, as our young people are becoming wiser and they're becoming more, they're brave, they don't have the fear that a lot of our other, you know, we came out of that fear. So that's always that fear of, well, you know, you could get, you know, so many years, and do you really want to? But our young people are really becoming more astute at standing up for their rights. And, you know, again, this is what this show hopes to do, is to stimulate conversation with Black lawyers and Black people. And if we stick together, and, you know, a great example, and I know I'm kind of rambling, but, of course, this young lady whose child was removed by Child Protective Services, Sister Marguerite, I know you talked about that on Sister Ava's show, she was able to raise funds for the purpose of hiring an attorney, and lots of money, is my understanding. She went on GoFundMe or something. And why is that a point? The point is that rather than those type of events, you know, removals, unjust actions, you know, just tragedies like hers, rather than people just not being able to fight back, our people are figuring out how to fight back. You know, I've seen people represent themselves sometimes and get some results. Because I think, Brother Jimmy, because we're actually down to 18 minutes, so we're pretty good. It goes into the question that we asked about are sometimes cases, is there no evidence? Are cases, are people charged with crimes sometimes where there's no evidence? I know you brought up drug cases, and that makes me think of confidential informants sometimes who are the key witnesses, but a lot of times that witness is so weak, the evidence is so non-reliable, it's horrible evidence, it would never stand up, you know, or should never stand up in trial. For example, you can't hear the tape recording. You know, this confidential informant is probably some kind of bad actor themselves. And so how can you take their word, you know, against someone? You know, but these are the types of cases oftentimes that are brought against our people. And so, again, do we see a lot of cases that really there is no evidence? And if people would stand up, you know, they could get better outcomes as opposed to taking plea bargains and stuff like that.
Well, I would say so.
Okay. And Sister Tiffany wants to comment as well.
Just real quick, Brother Attorney Jimmy, I was just going to say a quick fact check that for Sister Marguerite, I found that it stated 97% of the federal convictions are obtained through plea bargaining, and states roughly 94%. That's from 2019.
Wow. Did you hear that?
So that's
94%.
And then when you
Brother
talking
Jimmy.
About this evidence, oh, I'm sorry, when you were alluded to
no,
the overuse, so for sure the two-inch sword is pretty sharp. But in regards to the evidence, being, you know, for the wrongly convictions, for innocence, I know that, like you said, jailhouse informants or informants, period, with drug cases, obviously, as we talked about, critical objections not being made, inadequate defense, ineffective counsel, misused forensic science. I know a lot of DNA testing in the past several years, they have projects like the Innocent Project where they're doing more DNA testing, and they're exonerating persons who are innocent, right? And then, of course, as you said, false eyewitness misidentifications, false confessions, all that being, you know, admitted I'm sure Brother Jimmy can go into more details or specifics.
Right, because he's in that percentage. Look, Brother Jimmy, you're in that percentage that does try cases. Because, Sister Tiffany, did you say 94% of these state cases are being plea bargain?
Yeah, 90.
Yeah,
95.
That's a lot.
The way they set the system up is that most people cannot afford to hire a private lawyer. So they end up getting a public defender. And the public defender system is overwhelmed. On average, private attorney may have any given time, 50, 60 open cases. The prosecutor has 125, and then you double that, and that's what the public defender has. So there's no way they can try all these cases. And so a lot of times they're looking for a deal out of the gate. One thing about being a private attorney is we get the opportunity because, one, we're paid a little bit of money to look at the case and look at the evidence. And then my mentors, because they fought no-win cases for so long, I learned to look for a way to win a no-win case.
That's right.
Out of the gate. But there are a lot who don't. They just do their job, make their record, and keep going. And so, yeah, I can see that percentage as it relates to the federal system. And I could probably see that percentage as it relates to the state. But I don't think that sometimes people understand how many cases go through a particular place. So let me give you some facts to put with it. I remember when I was a student prosecutor in law school, and I got a chance to prosecute domestic battery, DUIs, things of that nature. But we did about 13,000 cases in this district court a year. And with these 13,000 cases that we did, we would have to go through roughly cases a month, which means if you break it down each week, we had to go through 250 cases on a Wednesday and Thursday. Well, there's no way we could try all those. So what we did is we would come out and we would see how many people really want to go to work today because we're going to waste your whole day. And so we would get 50 people to do that. And then we would find out if we gave you a better offer, who would go away. And then what we would do is we would take the most slam dunk case we could find and try it for 2 hours, get the best possible sentence, and try to intimidate the other people, because most of these are pro ses, from going to trial. And what would happen is we would literally get down to about 10 or 12 people, and we try to cut deals with those 10 or 12. We make the deal so sweet that you either would plea out or go away. And then when you get down to about your last 7 or 8, you walk up to the judge, you dismiss all of those cases because they really waited 10, 12 hours, and they won. They won because they wore you out. But in the flip side of the equation, instead of me getting 250 cases tried, I got 243 of them settled or plead in that day. So it's a numbers game for the prosecutor as well. So a lot of times the plea negotiation is just for judicial economy. Let's get it done. Because if not, prosecutors have to figure out how good their case is as well. I'll tell you the other thing. This is what I used to tell my students. Never go to court and plead guilty. Pleading guilty does not require the prosecutor to even look at the file. He doesn't even have to look at the file. He doesn't have to study and see what the weaknesses are. And a lot of times if you plead not guilty and walk it up to trial, which is what I've been doing for the last 2 months, is basically telling them any case they want to try, let's try it. And what is happening is I walk it up to trial, they discover their evidence is not good. And I've tried 5 jury trials, but I've gotten 9 dismissals because I've walked it all the way up to the day or two before trial, and I think I got 3 more coming. I was supposed to try a jury trial today. They punted on that. I'm supposed to try one starting next week. They're already asking for a continuance on that.
and they are trying to plead my guy out that they're asking for a continuous on to time served because they're not prepared. So a lot of times it's a matter of getting to the point where you force the prosecutor to have to do something. And sometimes they show up, other times they punt.
That's right. That's right. And it's interesting. So what our listeners are also hearing is, you know, we talked about the grand jury, and we see how the grand jury may not indict officers or other officials, but they definitely indict us many times. Like Brother Gerald Christmas, one of the attorneys, he said, you know, the grand jury, they'll indict a ham sandwich if you want them. Well, a lot of times that's us that are being indicted, and maybe these cases have no evidence. So perhaps there are too many cases. You know, we can see the overcharging. We can see the targeting. We can see the surveillance that is resulting in all these cases that are then, you know, used through a system where our people are really, this is why we're over-incarcerated. This is why innocent people are incarcerated as well. So I think it's a great, great discussion. And again, any calls, anybody want to get in the host queue, please press the number 1 to get in. Because as we wrap up, we want to talk about solutions. And listening to Brother Jimmy, we can definitely say hiring a black lawyer, one who will fight for you, really needs to be at the top of the list. We also heard from Sister Donna that we should not allow media perceptions to cloud our judgment as a lay person, because in lay person we say that as non-lawyers. But this is partly what the media is doing. Like she said, they're trying these cases in the media, and they're, you know, even though it's uncharged conduct that may be prejudicial and have no value, you know, this is being allowed to cloud people's judgment and make them biased. So another thing we would encourage is for people to know their rights and, you know, find out, do some research on your own rights. We're going to encourage, once again, the right to remain silent. Don't say anything. Don't sign anything. That's a big one because, again, they have to prove their cases. It is not us who need to prove that we're innocent. And that's something, Brother Jimmy, as we're leaving that whole standard of beyond a reasonable doubt and, I guess, innocent until proven guilty, are these things that you use in your practice, I'm sure. And you can tell
absolutely.
Us about
I mean,
that on the way
when
out.
Yes, sir. Well, I'll tell you two things. One, I tell my clients, you know, anytime you're arrested or anytime you're detained, you don't have to talk to the police other than giving them simple identifiers such as your license, name, you know, identifiers such as that.
Okay.
In Arkansas, if you give false information on your identifiers, it's a crime. However, you can be detained, but you are not committing a crime by not speaking at all. So if you say have a warrant, you don't tell them your name, your identifier, they take you into custody, at least you didn't pick up another crime. As it relates to trial, I tell the jury in the beginning that the citizen has the right to remain silent, and this goes throughout trial. So do you promise not to hold it against my client if he does not take the stand or if he doesn't put on a case? I always tell them, I said, I know how it is. I have children, and I know how it is that you want to hear both sides of the story. But our forefathers did not make a defendant have to put on his case. So do you agree not to hold it
right
against me? And you just I work that into what I'm doing. But, yes, all of the rights that are set up for a citizen, I either work it as it relates to trying to keep them from putting foot in said mouth, or confessing, and or from messing up their trial.
Beautiful. And again, we have the article about police officers in Illinois not being able to lie to juvenile defendants during interrogation. but they can still lie to adults, and even more so, you know, and this is all around the country, understand that police officers use those tactics. They lie to people in order to get what they want during interrogation. This is what that case law is saying. They can lie. And so the point is that utilize your strength, and your strength is to wait to go until you can talk to people who do what this for a living, and that can better advise you on how to best deal with certain situations before you speak, before you entertain a conversation. Don't, you know, because they like to also play on your smartness, like, oh, well, we know you think you're smarter. You smart, you know, they get into this ego. So just don't play those games, and maintain your right to remain silent. Sister Tiffany, did you want to say anything in closing? I thank you so much for all of the data and all of what you told us tonight. I appreciate it.
Praise be to Allah.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
Yes, ma'am. I learned a lot. State court is extremely – it's very different from federal and the circuit court, which I do when I'm in court. So I did learn a lot. There are some similarities, but there are differences. So I would just advise one who has maybe immigration or some federal case, whatnot, but to always, like you say, you want to get obviously a good creative attorney if you're in the defense or the affirmative, depending where you are in federal court. But you want to, the record of procedures, everything. You know, we want, like you were saying, with the critical objections and whatnot, you want to make sure you build your record. So, like Brother Jimmy was stating, in state court, you know, you have the ability to appeal. So that's crucial. So you definitely want to have that always, as an attorney, you want to always keep that in mind. Though it may not be as weighted, but you definitely want to build your record of procedure. So, like, I guess with that being said, thank you so much for the opportunity. And, again, I really learned a lot, and I appreciate it. Thank you.
Well, thank you, beloved, and thank you again, both Brother Jimmy. I would just like to give you the big appreciation for coming on. I think you gave our listeners so much information on how this thing called trial is actually done, because it is kind of like, isn't it like a almost like a sports event or some other area that has a lot of rules, you know, a lot of fouls, and a lot of times people don't know what they're seeing, and I think you really shed a lot of light on it for us, and I thank you so much for what you do. You keep fighting for us. So why don't you give us ways to reach both of you. Brother Jimmy, you're in Arkansas. Can you please tell the listeners how they can get in contact with you?
All right. You can always reach me on my office phone. It's 501-319-7647. You can reach me on Instagram. I believe it is. Let me look it up so I can give you the right thing. But I'm on there. It's automatically.
Okay.
Let's see. This is J period C period
ATTY.
So J period C period ATTY. You can find me on Facebook, Jimmy Morse. And so those will be the ways to connect with me.
Okay. Thank you, Brother Jimmy. Sister Tiffany, how to contact you?
Yeah. Oh, yes, based here in Los Angeles, but I am able to travel with federal law. Telephone number 213-248-2875, email tbmlawgroup@gmail.com.
Yes, ma'am, and thank you so much. And I am your host, Sister Pamela Muhammad, and thank you for listening to A Time for Justice. I would like to thank the Elevated Places team for all their help, Sister Donna Muhammad, Brother Terrence Muhammad, Sister Rona Muhammad. I'd like to also thank my daughter, Sister Samaya Muhammad, who is the person who handles so much for me, and I would
also remind you all to listen to the Elevated Places on Thursday at 7 p.m. Central Standard Time, and that is the Ask Dr. Ava show. And we thank Sister Dr. Ava for this Elevated Places network and wishing you all the best week as we continue to pray for our family in Louisiana and, you know, the places that have been struck by the hurricane. So have a good evening, and assalamu alaikum.
Thank you.